Opening up our Bibles to Matthew chapter 5 tonight, and we're going to be talking on the Sermon on the Mount. And just as a review, and it's particularly in this chapter, it's helpful to have this review. In the first 12 or 13 verses of the chapter, what you see is Jesus talking about the characteristics of the kingdom. And really what they have to do with is, if you're going to reframe it a little bit, if you put God at the proper place in your life, then you will have these characteristics. That's what Jesus is bringing out here. And he says it in such a way where he's talking about how blessed you would be to be in the kingdom of God. So he says, oh, the blessings of the poor in spirit. Or, oh, the blessings of those who mourn. Or, oh, the blessings of those who are meek. And he just thinks about how great it is to have these qualities in your life, because these qualities are an indication that you put God in the proper place in your heart. And that's really what Jesus does. And really, all of these things, that's what they reflect, is that Jesus is saying, this is what I do. This is how I live my life. And here are some of the blessings I have. But he's also saying everyone who does these things, everyone who has these characteristics, because God is in the proper place in their life, will have these blessings. Then, after verse 13, he says you are to be the salt of the earth and the light of the world. And these qualities have to do with how we serve God. The salt of the earth really deals with our commitment to the Lord, our steadfastness, our being willing to follow Jesus wherever he goes, to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind. That's the idea behind being the salt of the earth. That sort of characteristic will spare a nation and stop the rotting things from rotting because of your righteousness. And we saw an example of this when Abraham was talking to God about Sodom and Gomorrah. He said, if there's 50 righteous, will you sweep away the righteous with the unrighteous? And all the way down to 10 righteous. Well, those 10 righteous people would salt the whole area of Sodom and Gomorrah. And God said, I will spare it for the sake of the 10. You see the effect that righteous men have in the area they live, but also you see the quality of the man who's salt, where he loves God with all his heart, totally committed. And there's another aspect of this, of being the light of the world. This is the person who in their community reflects God, reflects God's qualities. And it says, you're the light of the world. He gives several examples, but one of them is a city on a hill. Maybe it's distant, but it's constant, and you know it's there, and when you see it, you know your direction. It talks about a lamp that's lit and placed in a spot where it's going to illuminate the darkness. It's not meant to be covered, to be sheltered, to be contained. It's meant to give light around it. Now, someone might see that city from a distance and start walking towards it, but when he arrives, there's going to be a lamp. And that lamp is going to show him some pitfalls that are around him, not in a judgmental way, but in a loving, kind, like God way. And then there's the light of the world. It says in verse 16, let your light shine before men in such a way that they see your good works and glorify the Father. Now, this is a personal thing, right? It's not just that they see the light. It's not that they get close enough to be exposed to it. Now they're experiencing the light for themselves. And when they experience it, they say, this is good. Isn't God great? And this concept really parallels with the idea of love your neighbor as yourself. And then Jesus goes on to say, unless you, I didn't come to abolish the law, I came to fulfill the law and the prophets. And he says, unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and Pharisees. Well, we see this same sort of language if you go to Matthew 22 and verse 37. They ask Jesus, what is the greatest commandment? And he says, the greatest commandment is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind. And the second is like it, love your neighbor as yourself. On these hang the whole law and the prophets. Jesus said, I didn't come to abolish the law and the prophets. I came to fulfill it. I came to show you what they mean, how to do it. And if you want to do it, if you want to be salt, if you want to be light, if you want to have these characteristics, if you want God in the proper place in your life, then this law needs to be a law of the heart, not a law that just dictates your actions. And he starts going through and comparing. Here's what you've been taught by the scribes and Pharisees. But now I'm going to tell you what is at the heart of the law. What is the law intended to impact in your heart? And how does it affect your relationship with God and your relationship with your neighbor? And so let's go ahead and get started looking at these. And I'm going to go through them. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on each one of these. But you'll see Jesus, as he teaches, bringing in elements of the law and clarifying them as to how the impact on the heart is going to be. So look with me in Matthew chapter 5. We'll start reading 21 through 26. You've heard that the ancients were told, you shall not commit murder, and whoever commits murder shall be liable to the court. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother shall be guilty before the court. And whoever says to his brother, you are good for nothing, shall be guilty before the Supreme Court. And whoever says, you fool, shall be guilty enough to go to the fiery hell. Therefore, if you are presenting your offering at the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your offering there before the altar. Go first be reconciled to your brother and come and present your offering. Make friends quickly with your opponent at law while you are with him on the way, so that your opponent will not hand you over to the judge and the judge to the officer, and you will be thrown into prison. Truly I say to you, you will not come out until you have paid up the last cent. So Jesus uses this formula that we see here. You have heard that it was said, but I say to you. You have heard that it said, you shall not commit murder. Now that's the big thing, murder. If you murder someone, you've gone too far. Now, if you're not murdering somebody, then you haven't gone too far. See, murder is the thing that you have to go to court for. Murder is the big ugly thing. But if you take one step back from murder, then it's justifiable. I mean, if someone treats you wrong and they make you angry, then why not treat them bad? Why not hate them? Why not persecute them? This is the place where they got. See, murder is the thing the law talks about, specifically as a breaking one of the Ten Commandments. Here we have the sixth commandment, murder. But Jesus says that's not how it works. And really, when you read the law, Jesus is not innovating here. He's bringing up the things the law is saying, and he's applying it in a very practical way. Just as a side note to the Sermon on the Mount, I was reading about it, and the way Jesus uses his language, all the words have just, I think, less than two syllables or three syllables. Like, it's just a short words, easy to understand, brilliantly formulated. In fact, linguists and people who study literature and stuff look at the Sermon on the Mount because it is so well done. It is on par with, I mean, probably above, actually, but as just from a literature perspective, like Seneca and Socrates and Pluto and those great thinkers that we think about, Jesus is on par and actually surpassing their thoughts as he formulates these ideas. They've taken certain ideas so far, but Jesus really pushes it to really God's wisdom. And so you just see Jesus just shining bright, just if you weren't talking religion, you're just talking about ideas that progress the concept of humanity. Jesus is just being brilliant in these things. But he takes this idea of you shall not commit murder, and he really says this is what God hoped to accomplish with that. See, they're saying I can go all the way up to the line, and Jesus says, no, actually, the idea is you need to stop way back here. You need to stop before it becomes the thought to murder. So he says there's a few things you might say about your brother. The first one is, He says, everyone who is angry at his brother shall be guilty before the court. This idea of anger here, I don't remember the two Greek words, but there are two Greek words. And this one has to do with resentment. Not a flash, angry in a minute, calm down in a minute kind of anger. This is a letting a resentment stew, holding it against somebody, continuing in anger. Jesus says, don't do that. I used a bottle of poison. It was Nelson Mandela. He said, resentment is like drinking poison, hoping it kills your enemy. That's the idea here. It's this burning vitriol against somebody for something they've done, whatever it is. The second one, it says, if you're angry at your brother, you will be guilty before the court. Now, this would be just sort of like in their cities, they would have a city council. They'd sit at the gate, and if you did something wrong in your city, you'd have to go stand trial for it. Now, if you committed a murder, you can read in Deuteronomy that those men are to make a careful examination of all the facts and determine, are you guilty or not? What happened here? And then they carry out the punishment. So, if you commit murder, you're guilty before the court. And Jesus is saying, no, this is if you're angry, you're guilty before the court. Now, this is dealing with issues of the heart. And I don't know how a court would determine the level of your anger, but there is some things in the law that talk about this. We'll get to it in a minute. The second thing, if you say to your brother, you good for nothing, or raka is the word. There's no real good way to translate raka, and so you'll have all different things. Empty-headed is one of them. I use a picture of this monkey up here, and he just does not look like a smart animal. I use another one here. This is my secondary picture. But you know, you look at something like that, and you just think, what a brainless animal. That thing looks totally worthless. I mean, its tongue's hanging. I don't even know if it has teeth. I don't even know if it can see. The thing's just totally worthless. Good for nothing. Empty-headed. What a pointless animal to have, right? And so if we might talk that way about animals, but if you take a man, your brother, somebody you know, and you assign this sort of worthlessness to them, that's this idea here. This guy is worthless. He's not good for anything. He's not worth me giving my time to him. He is so mindless, so empty-headed. That's the idea. It's just that it's more of a feeling it's communicating than an actual definition, but it's just this prejudice, this I already know what you're like before examining it, putting a low value on. That's the idea here. It's this, how do I evaluate you? The third one, it says, and whoever says to you, you fool, shall be guilty enough to go into the fiery hell. Here's the idea of casting judgment. That guy is going to hell. Now you just look at him, arbitrarily start assigning judgments to somebody. Well, he says, if you do that, you're guilty of the fiery hell as well. And so here are these different ways we might be angry at somebody. We might judge somebody. We might hold it against somebody, have this hate towards somebody. This is the different ways that works. Now, the old law talks about these things. If we turn over to Deuteronomy, and we'll go back to Deuteronomy 19 at least one more time tonight if you want to put a mark there. But in Deuteronomy 19 and verse 4, it says, now this is the case of a manslayer. So it's talking about cities of refuge. And, okay, so you accidentally kill somebody, so you flee to the city of refuge. Here are some of the rules regarding whether or not they'll let you in or turn you over to the Avenger of Blood. Now, in the case of a manslayer who may flee there and live there until he kills his... Oh. Now, this is the case of a manslayer who may flee there and live. to the city of refuge. When he kills his friend unintentionally, having not previously, as when a man goes into the forest, is this the one I'm? This may not be what I was thinking of, but we'll go with it anyway. It says, that's what I was looking for. Okay, now this is the case of the man. Verse 4 again. Now this is the case of the manslayer who may flee there and live. When he kills his friend unintentionally, not hating him previously, and when a man goes in, as when a man goes into the forest with his friend to cut wood, and swings the axe to cut down a tree, and the iron head slips off the handle and strikes his friend, that he dies, he may flee to the city of refuge. So here, and we'll skip down to 11 through 13. But if there is a man who hates his neighbor and lies in wait for him and rises up against him and strikes him so that he dies and flees to one of these cities, and the elders of the city shall send and take him from there and deliver him into the hand of the avenger of blood, that he may die. So now you have two situations. One is a guy, he goes out into the woods with his friend, someone he is not known to have hated. Now there's the thing. We don't have anything against each other. We are allies. We are friends. We are neighbors. We're going to work together. And an accident occurs. He can flee to the city of refuge and be safe. Now here's this other man. Now they're saying he was lying in wait, but let's just say two guys are going into the woods to work together, but the one guy is known to have a grudge against the other guy. He hasn't murdered him, he just hates him. And it's known he has a grudge. And he swings his axe and the head flies off, kills the other man. He's innocent, he did not mean to kill him. Can he stay in the city of refuge? No. That's what Jesus is teaching. That's the idea here. See, when you say, murder is the big thing, so I'm not going to murder, the law talks about that. There's a standard. You are not to be hating people, and if you are, it makes you guilty before the court. And that's the idea that Jesus is getting at here. See, it's a condition of the heart that's the problem. The murder is the outcome, but the condition of the heart is the problem. So Jesus says, people in my kingdom aren't going to be hating. They're not going to be angry. They're not going to be calling people worthless or condemning them unjustly in this way. In 1 John chapter 3, in verse 15, John writes about this. He says, everyone who hates his brother is a murderer, and you know that murderers have no eternal life abiding. A murderer has no eternal life abiding in him. Here again, you have this concept of when you hate your brother, you're violating the same law as if you murdered him. Now, you didn't murder him, but you're still guilty. That's what do not murder is meant to invoke in us, is I'm not going to get close to that. I'm going to have a right heart in all of this. So he uses some examples of that. He's like, don't be that way. Now, how serious is this? What does this mean? He says, when you go into the temple and you're going to give an offering and you get up there, he says, therefore, if you are presenting your offering at the altar, so when they had the tabernacle, Jesus had the temple, the altar would be burning, you'd be sacrificing your animal on here. If this was the door of the temple, and this was the altar, you stand right here to give your offering. Now, there's probably a line involved. You bring your animal up. You lay your hands on the animal's head. You say, my sins be on this animal. Here's what I've done. And I have repented. And now they're going to slay the animal. And you say, stop. Wait a minute. I forgot about something. We're going to have to put this on hold. That's what Jesus is saying. You're all the way there. You got the priest there. The fire's going. They got the knife. You're ready to present your offering, and you realize, I haven't really repented of this thing. I have still offended that person and I haven't tried to make it right. Jesus says, when you're in that position, leave the offering. In Micah 6 and verse 6, God talks about this, or the writer talks about this. It says, with what shall I come to the Lord and bow myself before the God on high? Shall I come to him with burnt offerings, with yearling calves? Does the Lord take delight in thousands of rams and 10,000s of rivers of oil? Shall I present my firstborn for my rebellious acts, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? He has told you, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you but to do justice, to love kindness, and to walk humbly with your God? Here's the idea of what does God require? Is it the sacrifice? No, it's the repentance. And the Jews would even say, the Day of Atonement wouldn't count for you if you were living in rebellion to God. You go, the Day of Atonement doesn't matter. Your sins are not repented of. You're still doing the same evil things. And Jesus says, if you find yourself in that position, how important is it to be right with your brother? It's so important that when you're at the temple, the very end, you're about to make the offering, stop. Go make it right. Now the second point he makes here piggybacks onto this point. If all the way to that point you're to stop, when should you start making things right with your brother? And that's what he talks about next. He's like, well, when should we start making things right with your brother? Verse 25. Make friends quickly with your opponent at law while you are with him on the way, so that your opponent may not hand you over to the judge and the judge to the officer and you be thrown into prison. So here's a guy, and in this case, he owes a debt. He borrowed money or something. He hasn't paid it back. And now the guy wants to drag him to court and sue him. He says, don't put it off that long. Deal with the problems while you can still deal with it without major consequences. This is one of those things I think about for my own self, as particularly regarding my children. You cannot avoid consequences. You can only postpone them, and they get worse. That's really the idea here. Stop trying to avoid the consequences to your actions. If you've done something wrong, own up to it and go take care of it right away. Don't let it fester. An example of that for me, I think about this, is the consequence to not raising up your children properly or to neglecting certain things. There's a consequence to that, and you may have to watch your children suffer. Now, that's not a condemnation. That's just if you do it wrong, there's a consequence to that. The consequence to not changing your oil is blowing up your engine, right? It's going to wear out quicker. There's consequences to putting things off, and you don't avoid them by not dealing with them. They get worse. And that's what Jesus is talking about here. Deal with things while it's easy. Start at the very beginning of a problem and make it right then. Make peace with your brother as you're walking with him to the court. Don't wait till you get there. After you get there, things get set in motion that you can't reverse. If you don't make an arrangement to pay your brother, in this case, you go to jail, they arrest you, they put you in some sort of a debtor's prison, now you're working labor for a minimum wage, and you won't get released until you pay off every cent. Now you might be able to negotiate with your friend, person to person, and he might be able to cut you short. Now, if you're angry at somebody and you put it off long enough, maybe you'll end up like Cain, where you murder your brother. And then when God said, you can't do what you've been doing, the ground is not going to yield its fruit to you anymore. And Cain says, my punishment is too great for me to bear. What did God say in the very beginning? If you do well, or if you do well, will not your countenance be raised? In the very beginning, God called him to do better, and he put it off until it became murder. And then he was cast out, and the thing he loved was lost to him, and he was put away from the face of the Lord. That's what you see going on here. In Proverbs chapter 25, verses 8 through 10, it says, do not go out and hastily argue your case. Otherwise, what will you do in the end when your neighbor humiliates you? Argue your case with your neighbor, and do not reveal the secret of another, or he who hears it will reproach you, and the evil report about you will not pass away. Here's the same idea. It's just go make peace with your neighbor. You have a problem with him, take care of it, get it dealt with. But even if you get all the way to the temple and you're offering your animal and you remember, deal with it then. There's still time to deal with that. So here's the first thing Jesus is teaching is, you've heard that it says don't murder, but I say to you, don't even be angry with your brother. Don't let that resentment stir in your heart. Here's the next one he talks about starting in verse 27. He says, you have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you, everyone who looks at a woman with lust for her, he has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye makes you stumble, tear it out and throw it from you. For it is better that you lose one of the parts of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into the hell. If your right hand makes you stumble, cut it off and throw it from you. For it is better to lose one of the parts of your body than for the whole body to go into hell. It was said, whoever sends his wife away, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife, except for the reason of unchastity, makes her commit adultery, and everyone who marries a divorced woman commits adultery. So here's another one Jesus deals with, and this one also is dealt with in the law. See, their idea was, I'm not going to commit adultery. Adultery is the thing. But I can get all the way up to this point, and it's still not adultery. Jesus says that's not right. The other way they may have tried to do this is, I'm not going to commit adultery because I'm going to divorce my wife and I'll marry the person I'm lusting after. Well, here it's not adultery. Jesus deals with these things. The first thing I want to talk about is in the law, if you go to Exodus chapter 20, verse 14, it says, you shall not commit adultery. In Exodus 20 and verse 17, it says, you shall not covet your neighbor's house, your neighbor's wife, your neighbor's animals, your neighbor's field. You shall not covet anything. Now I say I'm not going to commit adultery, but I'm coveting. Isn't that still breaking the law? Isn't that still a violation of one of the Ten Commandments? Aren't you still going against what God said? James 2 and verse 10 talks about this. It says that, in James 2:10, it says, don't you know if you violate one part of the law, you're guilty of the whole thing? You say, I don't commit murder, but I commit adultery. You're guilty of all. And that's really the idea here is the adultery is sort of the end of the road for lust. So Jesus deals with this. In the very same way, he talked about the other way. Make friends with your neighbor. Don't put it off. In this case, he says, if your right eye makes you stumble, tear it out and throw it from you. For it is better to lose one of the parts of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. If your right hand causes you to stumble, and so I accidentally got this picture right. It's his right hand and his right eye. I added an eye patch to Captain Hook here. But let's talk about that for a minute. Captain Hook lost an eye and he lost a hand. Does that mean he's no longer sinning? You see, no, he has a problem looking at things he shouldn't look at, so he cuts out an eye. Now he just has one eye to look at things he shouldn't look at, right? Mutilating your body does not change your heart. Jesus is not just saying, mutilate your body. What he's saying is do whatever it takes to remove the temptation from yourself. This idea here is don't be scandalous. The idea of stumble is the Greek word skandalizo, which means to cause to sin or to entice to sin. And so Jesus is saying, don't be scandalous. Don't cause yourself to sin. Don't entice yourself to sin. Don't put yourself in a position where you are coveting, because a position where you're coveting is going to lead to sinning. And so Jesus says, remove those things from your life. Remove the things that cause you to stumble. Don't be a one-eyed, one-handed, what do they call Captain Hook? There's another word, a sneakety snooker. Yeah. A scoundrel, a scandal, whatever you want to think. But don't be like that. It doesn't change, right? Don't be like him. Remove the temptation from in front of you. Change your heart. Let your heart be different. And then you can get rid of the other problems. And so here, again, he talks about with the divorce, it's the very same thing. He says, whoever sends his wife away, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you, everyone that divorces his wife, except for the reason of unchastity, makes her commit adultery, and whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. So here's another issue. I send her away for no reason at all. Guess what? If she gets married, it's adultery. If the person who marries her is an adulterer, so what's that say about me? I'm an adulterer too. That's what that means, is don't get divorced in this way. This is not a solution. This is a violation of the law. See, he's saying, be faithful to your wife. Just stay with your wife. That's really the thing. When you get married, stay married to that woman for your life. Be faithful to her. And if you start having this problem with lust, cut it out of your life. Don't keep it around. He's saying that when you divorce, it equals adultery. Here's another one he deals with it in verse 33. Again, you have heard that the ancients were told, you shall not make false vows, but you shall fulfill your vows to the Lord. But I say to you, make no oath at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by earth, for it is the footstool of his feet, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Nor shall you make an oath by your head, for you cannot make one hair white or black. But let your statement be yes, yes, or no, no. Anything beyond these is of evil. So here's Jesus talking about this, and he actually talks about this at length in Matthew chapter 22, as he's condemning Matthew 23, as he condemns the practice of the hypocrites, of the scribes and Pharisees. Matthew 23:16. Woe to you blind guides who say, whoever swears by the temple, that is nothing. But whoever swears by the gold of the temple is obligated. You fools and blind men, which is more important, the gold or the temple that sanctified the gold? And whoever swears by the altar, that is nothing. But whoever swears by the offering on it, he is obligated. You blind men, which is more important, the offering or the altar that sanctifies the offering? Therefore, whoever swears by the altar swears by both the altar and everything on it. Whoever swears by the temple swears by both the temple and him who dwells in it. And whoever swears by heaven swears by both the throne of God and by him who sits upon it. So here you have Jesus making this condemnation because they started doing this, crossing their fingers behind their back. Oh yeah, I'll do that for you, no problem. Intentionally misleading. See, I swore by the temple. I didn't swear by the gold on the temple, so they should have known that. They should have known I wasn't going to do it. I only swore by the temple. I only swore by the altar. I didn't swear by the offering. And so they had this game they liked to play. And Jesus said, keep your word. Do what you say you're going to do. If you make an agreement, number one, so we use all our little hand signals here. The first one is a finger tied around your string. Remember when you give your word. Don't forget. As I think about myself, and I think about where I forget to keep my word, a lot of the times I say I'll pray for someone and then I'll forget about it. You need to remember. I've started the practice, but I say I'm going to pray for someone. I do it right then and there when I say it, so that way I'm not forgetting. See, you need to remember when you give your word. You need to schedule it. Make time. It doesn't matter if you don't. I said I'd do it, but I don't really have time. Make time. You gave your word. Let your yes be yes. The next thing, get it done, right? The thumbs up. We got her done. Let me bring in one element to this. Here's this happy family. They'll stay happy because the parents keep their word to the kids. And that means if you say you're going to do something, do it. Let your yes be yes and your no be no. A lot of times, we make threats and don't follow through on it. Now, if you say you're going to do something and you don't do it enough times, will your kids believe you? No, they stop believing you. You don't keep your word. If you tell them no, and then they throw the fit, or they do their thing that they do, and you change your no to a yes, and you do that enough times, are your kids going to believe you? No. And so, that's the way it works sometimes in our families. And so I bring this up just to say, this applies to all areas of life. Not just between adults, but also between our families. Something we can work on is let your yes be yes and your no be no. Jesus said, keep your word. I think I'm going to stop right there. We're close to the end of our hour, and I just figured I'd go until I ran out of time. So as we consider these things, what Jesus is teaching here is following God's law, holding to His ways, is a matter of the heart. If you have a heart that says, I will love God, I do love God with all that I am, and you have a heart that says, I love my neighbor, I'm going to do what's right by him, a lot of these problems would be avoided. The law is not there so we can check the boxes and say, I get the gold star because I did all the things I was supposed to do. The law is there to teach us how to condition our heart to be right with God. And that's what Jesus is teaching here. He's saying, you've heard that it was said, but that's not all there is to it. These laws are meant to have an impact on your heart. If you're here tonight and you examine your own heart and you need to make some changes and you'd like help with that, I'd invite you to come forward now as we stand and sing the song of invitation.